Everyone, Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. We have never had, I keep saying this, I'm going to keep on saying it, as much engagement, downloads, all the good things you want in a podcast from an episode. This was referencing our emergency episode we dropped on Friday. So we are continuing this style of format. Sagar and I are going to go back and forth for a bit, and then we're going to answer questions from the audience, and we're going to keep on doing this moving forward. Quick reminder, this is part of our daily Ukraine crisis push. So I just did an episode on sanctions with Nate Sibley yesterday. We have this discussion episode coming out today. And then tomorrow we have an episode with counterinsurgency. So many different topics. Definitely write in to realignmentpod@gmail.com if you want to let us know what we should hit, given the fact that we have a lot of content to fill. Quick reminders, lots of books are going to get mentioned, so you can find the running bookshop list, help support the show. Two, you can send us a tip. We're not doing super chats, but it's a good way of showing that you guys really enjoyed it. We had a large number come in the face of last Friday's episode. And then finally, it's Thursday, so we're sending out a Substack where we are going to put together all the content we're doing. So definitely go check out there. Let's start with the very basic thing, Sagar. You and I just did State of the Union reactions on Breaking Points, Crystal Kyle. Let's just get a reaction from you as to Biden's articulation around Ukraine, but then just his broader administration's performance.
Yeah, I think he really hit the nail on the head. I think he struck exactly the right tone, which was NATO is the tripwire. It's the red line. Don't cross it. We obviously stand with Ukraine, but we're not sending any troops to Ukraine under any circumstances. And also, we need to significantly calm down the tensions on any nuclear exchange. So saying, look, it's going to be okay. I think he said that twice. It's going to be okay. That was really important. But one of the things we pointed to, Marshall, is unfortunately the president's delivery is lackluster, and that is a problem. On the policy front, the one good thing is, and I just saw this, there was a scheduled ICBM test from the US that they claim had nothing to do with Russia, and they just went ahead and canceled it. So again, the policy is now downstream of the rhetoric on those two things. The Pentagon spokesperson himself, John Kirby, tweeted out explicitly a clip of himself saying, we are not doing a no-fly zone. So I put all of these things together, and I'm very encouraged by the tone of the administration.
Yeah, it's funny. I genuinely, because we're not talking about American politics. This has nothing to do with the midterms. This has nothing to do with the 2024 election. We're speaking purely about Biden's performance as president. I don't care that Biden is not articulate in the sense that if Biden, imagine the worst case scenario of Biden right now. Like, let's say Biden's framing was, I need to go. This is basically the MSNBC. This is who Adam Kinzinger wishes he was. I am going to go mano a mano with Putin. I'm going to stand up to him. I'm going to give these Winston Churchillian speeches. I am the representative of the West. Honestly, this is a tack that Macron tried taking before the invasion actually happened to a large degree. Biden's not doing that. Biden is not making this about him. Biden is basically saying, look, I'm going to sit back. I'm going to be in the shadows here. I'm going to talk with our allies, and I'm going to tamp down on any craziness that happens. I've had a lot of friends and just honestly listeners who will see something happen and they will see, oh my gosh, this former NATO general says that we should do a no-fly zone, even if that could lead to conflict with Russia. Or this person, like Adam Kinzinger, said this other thing. We're so worried. Are these people going to start a Twitter mob? Joe Biden doesn't care. Like, once again, there are so many different areas where Joe Biden's various policy positions or his proclivities are going to cause issues. But this is actually one where his just frankly, his age and the lacking of caring is perfectly suited for what a US president needs right now.
Yeah, I agree with that. Unfortunately, like you said, from a political angle, it's not the best. But at the very least, on the downstream policy front, we're okay. That's very encouraging to me. I think that that is the single most important thing. I do think you should be careful too, though, with the NATO, the former NATO commander Breedlove. I was freaked out about it. And I think what it is, Marshall, is what scares me is that it's just Joe standing in between us and them. And I really do mean that. I mean, I have no confidence on the Trump side that he would act. Here's what it is with Trump. The variance is all over the map. For example, the day of the invasion, he's like, what a genius. Today, he called it a Holocaust.
He's referring to Putin.
Like, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm talking about Trump. Trump said Putin was a genius. Today, the day you and I are taping, he called it a Holocaust. So on the one hand, it's like total, I don't know, nothing, no action. It's like, okay, you know, words have meaning. You say there's a Holocaust going on, then you're implying that we should go to war. And I have no confidence that he himself wouldn't get bamboozled by those forces. Another example is Kamala Harris. Kamala is not the brightest bulb in the bunch. Okay. If she were president, I would be scared shitless right now because she doesn't have any real foreign policy convictions. She just was going to go with whatever the DC establishment were to tell her to do. And we would be a lot closer, I think, to war than we are under Biden. So look, I think we frankly got very lucky on this front whenever it came to Joe Biden from this. But the reason why I don't think you should discount why it's so scary is you've got a 79-year-old man who is the only thing standing between them and some serious escalation on the in the war with Russia.
You know what's funny? We like to avoid palace intrigue, but this is helping me realize that sometimes palace intrigue is actually useful. So everyone, especially the audience, go back to 2016 through 2020. We knew so many details, but all these different people in the White House,
right.
You would hear about secretaries leaking to Politico people. Right. There's 15 different tell-all books. Other than Jake Sullivan, who I like, other than Anthony Blinken, who I directionally like, I actually don't know anyone in these broad spaces that you're describing, Sagar. So it's this really funny this demonstration of the fact that, A, like, well, at least good job, Biden. I'll keep up my showing for keeping a tight ship. But it just means that if we were having this conversation in 2017, you and I'd be saying, well, here's how this undersecretary
who's leaking. Yeah, it's like, here's what Steve Bannon thinks. Here's what Colonel Douglas.
Here's what Jared thinks.
Here's what Jared thinks. And here's what John Bolton thinks. So who wins? We have no idea. And it would be some massive bureaucratic warfare. That being said, we shouldn't undercount that just because there isn't as much drama on the front-facing side, that some of that stuff isn't happening. For example, on the day of the invasion, there was something that made its way all the way up to the principals meeting of the NSC. What people don't know about this, principals meeting is when the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Treasury, basically all the top meetings, the top people meet before they brief the president on options. And the job of the NSC, the National Security Council, is to present the president with options during a national security crisis. Well, one of the options that they presented him, which was, from what I've read, was a legit cyber attack on the Russian military in order to, quote, disrupt their operations. I saw that and I was like, wow. I mean, the fact that that went through the interagency process is not an accident. This is obviously being pushed by somebody. It's just that I don't know who the people's names are. So once again, these are all things, by the way, I think that would be incredibly dangerous. We should not do that. And the reason why that all of this kind of intrigue and all this stuff matters is, like I just said, we've only got Biden standing in between a whole lot of nonsense. Obama himself got bamboozled quite a bit whenever he was president of the United States. Biden, just because he's so old and stubborn, luckily that hasn't happened yet. But let's say he dies and Kamala is the president. I think we're really in for it. I think that those forces become a lot more important. And that is where a lot of my fear on this comes from, which is, I mean, how much longer is he going to be president? 3 years? And it's like, that's not that long of a time, man. You know, and when you watch those forces grow, it's like, they may not be in power right now, but they will be. They could be. You think this war is going to be over in 3 years? I don't think so. I'm not saying there'll be daily fighting in the streets of Kiev, but political solution in 3 years? No way.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting here is you're getting to a debate you and I got into right before this State of the Union coverage started last night, where I actually have no problem. And I think it's actually a good thing that when the NSC meetings are getting held, you are seeing all of the options on the table. So you are seeing the cyber attack option. I think it's a good thing, while cringe, I think it's a good thing that Adam Kinzinger was just very direct with saying, hey, we should start a no-fly zone. Because if we're looking at a lot of these crises, these idea of these like potential nuclear conflicts, now that Putin's raised the specter of that, like obviously we would not be using nuclear weapons in an affirmative way here, things spiral when people don't have time to consider and don't have time to think. So here's what I would see as the worst case scenario. Here's why I think this was the best case scenario. Adam Kinzinger, before most people really made up their mind or even thought of ideas like no-fly zones, Adam Kinzinger says, hey, we need a no-fly zone. The second he did that, by raising the prospect of this idea in good faith, I clearly think he believes that's the right policy, it was pretty resoundingly defeated. Not just on Twitter in terms of the quote tweets and the dunks, but every single person, whether they're in the Senate, in the House, in the NSC, had to take a position. The position was, wow, not only do we not think this is the right idea at a policy level, but also we think this is a bad idea at a public political consensus perspective. Look at Libya. Why did we impose a no-fly zone in Libya? Once again, it was a very complicated issue at the time. Like, once again, like, that's a whole thing. It's the world of 2011, 2012. But once again, you had the no-fly zone get imposed because people saw that there were Libyan forces going to commit what could arguably be described as ethnic cleansing. People thought there's going to be a serious event. There was no thought about, okay, what does a no-fly zone mean? How is that going to make our relationship with the conflict change? Because Kinzinger raised this question, this time, same thing with your cyber attack example, we are having very explicit conversations rather than having them sit in the background.
Here's my counter to you. That requires somebody who thinks in the chair. And this is why, and by the way, that's not usually the norm. And especially in modern times. We're about to get wonky. So everybody stick with us.
They like this when you do it. So go for
okay.
It.
So this is, it's been fun to use my, my graduate school education. A lot of this stuff is coming back. So one of the texts that we were obsessed with in grad school was called The Essence of Decision, Explaining the Cuba Missile Crisis by Graham Allison. Now, the reason that matters is that Allison puts forward three separate different theories of politics, and this has always stuck with me: the rational actor model, the organizational process model, and then the bureaucratic politics model. The rational actor model is basically that the chief deciders are Kennedy and Khrushchev, that they were acting rationally in the different steps that they took in order to avert nuclear war. The organizational process model, and this is where things get really interesting, is that the organizational decision-making style of the United States, in specifically with Kennedy having a process known as XCOM, where he would sit there and deliberate for hours with the chief principals, as well as the Khrushchev Politburo decision-making haphazard process, that those two organizational models bubbled up different scenarios, which resulted in the different actions that led to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then finally is the bureaucratic politics model, which is that statesmen most often are far too beholden to the options that they are presented. And I saw a lot of this play out under the Trump administration. So let me explain this, which is that Trump doesn't know a goddamn thing about Afghanistan. He says, I want to get out. Everybody in the Pentagon doesn't want to get out. So here's what they say. They go, well, sir, you got three options. Maximalist option, send 70,000 troops. He goes, that's fucking crazy. Second option, he's like, well, you can surge 15. Third option, you can keep the current status. And he's like, no, but I want to get out. But here's the thing. For him to get out, it would require him to order a separate plan, a separate option to be discussed, all sorts of ways that the bureaucracy can stop this stuff from happening. So I think a more simplistic way, and what you were referring to, is a more rational actor model. But for that to work, you need a rational actor to be in the chair. And I think that the organizational, the bureaucratic politics aspect of this is significantly downplayed. So what I meant by whenever I saw that cyber attack thing, that's not because it's a rational move. You can think it is. I'm saying, you only get 4, 5, maybe, in front of the president. When one of those gets in there, it's because of a vested interest. So here's why I'm talking about the bureaucratic politics model of Graham Allison's Essence of Decision. And when you really start to understand how this stuff works, like, there's a National Security Council, sure. But below that, there's something called the deputies meeting. And below that, there's even all these sub meetings that happen that eventually make it so that all of this is forged by a consensus. And that can be good and that can be bad. It can be good if you have legitimately opposing views. It can be bad if you don't have that many opposing views within the process. So I know I just droned on for a long time, but I think this is important for people to understand in terms of how exactly some of this stuff works and how much of what you're talking about is predicated on having somebody who is a quote unquote rational actor in the chair whenever they're presented with these types of options. The book is extremely dull, by the way, and I don't recommend that you read it for fun, but it's important to think about.
Yeah, I think the one quick thing I'd say before we move on is I'll buy into the models you're displaying, but I think the issue in the Trump example, when it comes to bureaucracy and then the rational actor, is that Trump and his generals, the Defense Department bureaucracy, weren't aligned in their broader worldview and framework. What makes me confident about the process that's going on in government is if you are in the Biden NSC, if you have a position of actual responsibility and aren't just a tweeter or a congressman who's about to leave office because he was redistricted out of office, your incentive is we do not want to escalate this to nuclear war. So I think there's a constrained environment where the incentives between the bureaucracy and Biden as a decision maker are lined up well. And I think once again, I'm
roughly on this case, but let me throw it back at you. 2009, yeah. Obama, take nuclear war out of it. Obama does not want to, he wants to win the good war and all of that. Basically, he and Biden start challenging all of the assumptions of the Afghan surge in a Situation Room. But he's a young man, he's a young president. He doesn't really know how a lot of this stuff works. His chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, starts going out and giving speeches saying explicitly that we can't do this without X amount of troops. And this is before Obama has made a decision. Obama calls him into his office and he's like, hey, who works for who here? He's like, oh, I'm so sorry, her, all of that. And suddenly you still yet be C2C anonymous leaks and all these other very well-placed sources show up in the New York Times and in the decision-making apparatus around DC. And then finally, when the options get presented to Obama for Afghanistan, he only has three options, none of which he wants. And he's been boxed in both politically in terms of Congress and in terms of the national media environment. So was he truly in charge whenever he made that decision? This is why I think it's important to finish,
like once again, I'm not dismissing the frame you're providing. I'm just, once again, the question here is, are people scared that Biden is going to get boxed in to fighting a nuclear war because Adam Kinzinger is putting pressure on him? My answer here is that A, there are no White House leaks right now, to your point. So that could happen. But what I am saying is we've been in this crisis for over a month. And my point is, I'm not dismissing the existence of the bad incentives and structures you're describing. I am just saying what I tell people, and once again, everyone in the audience, you're going to keep hearing these examples of something scary happening. What I would point them to is, it seems to me the rational / bureaucratic process is working right now because everyone agrees. It's one of the few points of agreement in American politics. 80% plus people do not want to risk a nuclear war, a number which is reflected in that broader point.
Let me push you a little bit though, yeah. Marshall. One second. What if they do to Kiev what they did to Aleppo? You think that same thing stands? I don't think so. I think the media pressure is going to be tremendous whenever it comes. Like, remember what happened in Aleppo. We're talking about 100, 200,000 people died. The entire city is leveled. Civilians literally slaughtered in the streets. Kids getting maimed by Russian cluster bombs. All of that happened. I lived through it. I actually covered it. You'll remember a lot of this. Emotions were very high at the time, and Obama held off of it. But this is Europe. This is also 2022. This is Russia. You think that the same calls from within the administration for a no-fly zone would not be as potent at that time? I think
this is why I'm turning into the Biden show this episode. The second Biden made clear that there would be no troops and that the thing we are defending against is nuclear conflict, that essentially boxed it in. Now the critique of Biden, and this is I think the smarter critique I'm seeing from people who don't agree with the Biden policy, is basically, listen, throughout the Cold War, there were numerous examples where if we were purely making every decision based on the fact that they're going to launch a nuke, we wouldn't do what we did. So we wouldn't, for example, let's say, keep defending Berlin after 1961 because, well, they could launch a nuclear weapon, so we need to get out. We didn't abolish NATO because they had a nuclear weapon. So they think that Biden is misjudging the degree of nuclear threat and by framing this issue as we either do nothing or we fight a nuclear war in Western Europe and around the globe, they would say that that is unfair framing. But once again, in this case, I think that would be true. That would be true on a long scale. And I think it would be a terrible way to conduct foreign policy. China has nukes. We can't literally say, well, we have to leave Japan because even though the Japanese want us there, but Chinese have nukes. And if they have nukes, they could nuke us. We don't want a nuclear war. That would be a bad policy. But in this case specifically, where, as people have tweeted, a 1% chance of nuclear war would be unacceptable, obviously, that's working. For the next one, so I'm going to borrow a quick monologue space since you got yours, though it was very, very well Take appreciated. It. This is a audience thing that people really wanted from me. People wanted me to clarify my position as to the intelligence community, because this was the debate that everyone really, really, really liked. Mm. And it's really fascinating because the responses I got ran all along the gamut. So they ran from, you could get it, Glenn Greenwald adjacent listener saying, I didn't know Marshall was an establishment shill, to people saying things like, well, Marshall was right, or other people are saying, and this I think is the answer I'm most interested in, which is that, and look, it was a heated debate, so I'm not holding us perfect to our words, but someone saying, intellectually, I want to agree with Marshall in terms of the need for an intelligence community and need to trust information. But I emotionally, heart-based, agree with Sagar, given the trust that's been lost. So I think that's just the median listener. That was Ben Sagar back from Oregon, because that's just like what the mean person probably feels. So here's what my position is. And this is very key. And I've really realized after thinking about this, how important of a debate this is. Here's what happened in 2003. And Sagar, this is where you should jump in at any point when you want. In 2003, the Bush administration weaponized CIA analysis. If you said, hey, I'm a little skeptical of invading Iraq while we still haven't defeated the Taliban and still haven't gotten Osama bin Laden, I'm a little skeptical that a Saddam Hussein who was wrecked 15 years ago during Desert Storm, I'm skeptical if he has a nuclear program. And actually, the weapons inspectors, Hans Blix, oops, I almost used the Team America World Police pronunciation. Most people in my age court will get the reference. I'm not going to say it on the air here. Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, is saying he doesn't think there are weapons. Our allies are saying there are no weapons. I'm skeptical. What people would do, hawkish people, and as a hawk, I need to own this, they would say, well, Sagar, for saying that, we have CIA. The CIA says this is true. Are you unpatriotic? This is, you know, David Frum. He had a whole article called, Unpatriotic Conservatives. You are ignoring the CIA. They have agents. They are risking their lives. How dare you do this? All these various things. That is what weaponization of intelligence looks like. And that is a world that we cannot live in. The world that I want to live in, once again, is a world where we could do the following. We could say, hey, we cannot have rosy eyes towards the CIA. Let's even talk about this in this example. I was touting the intelligence community's capabilities as regards to the invasion. Well, guess what? They also said that Kyiv was going to fall in 3 days, and it hasn't fallen. So once again, it's complicated. Anyone who claims that the CIA is unimpeachable, the CIA always gets it right. You know this from your Cold War history. It's very dangerous when people claim intelligence is a science. We know this. We have, I mean, this is your Vietnam War history. This is Robert McNamara and his whiz kids calculating. Yep. We've calculated if we drop 4.5 tons of bombs on this bridge in 2 weeks, the Vietnam Ho Chi Minh Trail will be shut down. Collapse. And that's why we can send these 50,000 troops, because they will be out, we calculate, by November 1967. That is the disaster that we're basically talking about. And that is what I'm entirely rejecting. What I basically want to live in is a world where we don't put the CIA on a pedestal and treat them as just another set of tools. So just as there's a Congressional Budget Office, there's a Congressional Research Service, there's a National Security Agency, there are universities, there are think tanks, there are newspapers, there are YouTube podcast takeovers like ourselves, the CIA is entrusted with a very important tool role in this set. And what they need to do is they need to be treated as a tool. They are not going to be treated as something which is unimpeachable, because it leads to disaster. But that's what I want to do. Because I think that the solution to the person in the middle who feels that there's no way forward, I think your beef isn't really even with the idea of intelligence agencies, AKA, hey, Sagar, you're a 29-year-old analyst, do a report on uranium levels in Baghdad. That's a tool, like that's analysis. Your real beef is with the Bush administration weaponizing that. Your beef is with Colin Powell taking that. And instead of accepting that as the alternative to what happened last week, we should basically just say, hey, look, this is a tool. We need to make judgments as it go. And then one other thing to add, and this is a point that Aaron Visser, our researcher, pointed out, you should also judge these things based upon context and scale. So once again, Iraq, 2003. George W. Bush is affirmatively saying we are going to launch a massive regime change, democracy promoting invasion of Iraq. The bar for what the intelligence community has to provide in that case has to be incredibly, frankly, nearly insurmountably high, in my opinion. In this case, when you have 150,000 plus Russians on the border of Ukraine, that is a case where I say, okay, wow, like not only is this not us trying to affirmatively invade. And actually, by the way, do you know what would change my calculus on the invasion claim? What if the CIA, no, because it's not even how it really works. What if Biden is waving CIA info packets saying, quote, well, the CIA said he's about to invade, we need to launch a preemptive strike. That entirely changes the context. So because Biden was saying the CIA and our intelligence agencies have serious intelligence that indicates that that Putin intends to invade, because of the fact that there were the troops there, but as Dmitry Kofinas talked about in our episode last week, because you could see this in open source intelligence, because Europeans were also launching these warnings too. So this isn't as if anyone except Putin was saying it. Frankly, the only people who were pushing back on this, and I think this was to his discredit, was Zelensky. I think Zelensky incredibly miscalculated. When I think he's done an amazing job the second the tanks rolled in, but it was a huge miscalculation to try to prevent panic by saying this wasn't going to happen, everything was fine. But yeah, I'd love to hear your perspective on this.
So I think when you confine it to this, it's fine, but it's not just about Iraq. And I think that this is the key thing to understand. I had doubt about the intelligence community because of Iraq. And I was mostly in the position that you were in. And then the Trump administration happened. And it was an actual political weaponization of the intelligence community. And we don't have to litigate Russiagate and a lot of the nonsense that I saw. I also realized you got to sit a lot of these fights out, but I was in the trenches in terms of covering it as a White House correspondent. But I watched these things, which I knew were complete bullshit. I mean, the Russian bounty story on Afghanistan, so many of the leaks that came out of the administration on the Trump administration's, whatever you think of the policy, attempt at establishing detente with Russia, with the leaking of his transcripts with foreign leaders. I can literally, there are endless examples of this, where I would see politically motivated intelligence used specifically to ensure a foreign policy outcome, which was of the establishment mindset. Now, keep in mind, I'm not saying that this is a conspiracy to make money. And I think this is where some of the progressives get it completely wrong. Usually it's not in the service of money. It's honestly worse. It's in the service of ideology, which makes it more pernicious and more difficult to stamp out. And that is where my total distrust came from, which is watching the agency, not just that agency, all, because it's like 29 different intelligence agencies. And even, you know, what you're talking about, it probably wasn't in the CIA. It was probably like the Geospatial Intelligence Agency or whatever, whenever it comes to maps. There's a lot of these little ones, DIA, Defense Intelligence, whatever. More what it is that watching that happen and the amount of political pressure and domestic political corruption, and I mean, really do mean that, go to the heart of the intel, made it so that I was like, I don't trust a fucking word these people say. And I think I miscalculated and I took that too far. That being said, I mean, I never disbelieved there were 180,000 troops around Ukraine. I was just like, I don't think he's going to invade. I was like, I think Putin is going to use this as a chit in order to, and I actually, this is part of why I think what he did was so dumb. I actually am pretty certain that Zelensky probably would have given up on NATO. He already said, maybe NATO is a dream. I'm pretty sure he probably would have signed something If he had continued, let's say this continued for another month and there was like an escalating tension. And by the way, I would have supported that. I think that would have been a good thing. So I think Putin could have gotten what he wanted. It wasn't irrational, I think, in order to assume that was happening. And I think that my doubt in what they were saying comes from not just 2003, but living through 2017 onward and watching the domestic political weaponization of the U.S. intelligence community on that front day after day, watching it all become a political football. That is what really grossed me out. And then you add on Afghanistan on top of that. I mean, I think that what they did on Afghanistan was outrageous. One of the most outrageous things I've ever seen. And this, you know, they got to defend Joe Biden here.
What thing are you referring to?
I mean, just the absolute weaponization in the intel community to be like, we told them everything was going to be terrible, and blaming the administration for every single one of the moves, as if they hadn't been running these programs for 20 years and have been lying straight to our faces about the efficacy of a whole lot of the stuff that they were doing inside of Afghanistan. They, you know, put all of these strategic leaks to make it as if it was on Biden himself, and not that the entire underlying edifice was a complete farce. That was their fault. And so that, again, combined with this is bipartisan. They'll go and leak and, you know, wage war or whatever against anybody who is threatening. I don't even, when I say legitimate interest too, it's so hard because it's not budgets, it's ideology. It's also brand image. I can't say too much about this, but they care a lot about their brand, a lot more than a lot of people think, and are very conscious about how they're perceived by America. And they're doing backflips right now because they know that they have a lot more, that people like me have an egg on their face, and that they have a lot more credibility in their eyes. And if you think that that's not going to be used to a domestic political thing, like, I don't know what to tell you. It certainly is.
And this is, and I think this is where I'll just push you for a second, because it's easy for us. It's funny. Someone's comment made me realize that I'm not, as we're doing more of these discussion episodes, people are like, oh, like, I'm getting more of what Sagar and Marshall's perspectives are beyond just the question. I'm like not interested in being a critic. And I'm not saying like that's what you want to do, but I have no interest in being forever on the outside, like shouting at the various, oftentimes real sins of the political, military, defense establishment, et cetera. I want this to be a place where, once again, you know this, man, like, we have friends in the CIA who listen to this show. Like, we have people in the White House who listen to the show, and I want them to hear what you're saying. And I want them to, I want a politician who cares about addressing the issues you just described to do something about them. And then I also want people who are in these agencies to understand how serious people are about the lack of trust in their abilities. Like, this is not the, I just read a book. It's called the Quiet Americans. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you'd really enjoy it. It's on Audible. It's about the CIA and the OSS during World War II and immediately after, basically going into the 50s and 60s. And like,
Dulles Brothers and a lot of the fuckery that was important.
Even with the Dulles Brothers, it's complicated. But my point is basically, like, I don't think people in the CIA understand the lack of trust. And I, once again, as like, quote unquote establishment person here, I think I'll embrace that role. I didn't understand that until I really saw like that segment that we did here just blow up. So what I want to basically say is, I don't want my pushback to be construed as saying your distrust is unwarranted. What I am basically saying is, I don't want people who I want to listen and then do something. I don't want this to be a boomer YouTube show where we just whine about things. I want people to hear this and say, hey, if I'm someone who works the CIA and I'm our age, how can I perform better so my peers don't think I'm a sack of shit? And if you're a left critic or a right critic, how do I still take intelligence and make good decisions and evaluate the world through proper lenses without having to just buy hook, line, and sinker like the Iraq War? So yeah. I think that's the key. I think that's the correction, basically saying, I'm not pushing back on your distrust. I just don't want it to, because look, some people interpreted you as saying you are basically never, ever, ever going to trust them despite what happened. And I don't think that is what you were saying.
No, that's not what I was saying. I was saying if this is currently constituted, and this is why it is a political problem, which is that what we actually do need is a church committee of sorts, not necessarily the exact.
Can you explain what the church committee was?
But of that style. The church committee.
Man, wait, quick thing, Senator, everything is the 70s right now. That's 76.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. I thought it was 75, but I was going to say.
Yeah, no, you're correct.
One of those years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 1975, Senator Frank Church, Idaho.
Anyway,
yeah. Oh, look at me.
Yeah. Okay. You.
Senator Frank Church, 1975 of Idaho, is a longtime critic of the intelligence community, uses the backlash against the Vietnam War, the distrust in government of Watergate to launch the Church Committee. And the Church Committee is a wholesale investigation and unearthing of the unethical behavior undertaken by the CIA, by the FBI, kind of destroying the last vestiges of Hooverism and the dullest arrogance, I think.
Untouchability. The idea of untouchability.
Yes. The at that time, it's difficult for people to understand. They were seen as co-equal branches of government. Like, they looked at themselves in the same vein as the elected president of the United States, arguably at some points had more power. And there's a lot more time, obviously, to say about that, especially in the Kennedy and the Eisenhower years, whenever you read about exactly what was happening. So I think that what I'm trying to get at is, this is why it's sad that we don't have the same political leadership. Frank Church was, he'd probably be more described today as akin to a leftist, but he was a serious guy. He wasn't out there chasing headlines. He legitimately wanted to reform the US intelligence community. And I don't see any of that right now. I see a bunch of people screaming about, you know, Obamagate, Russiagate, or, you know, vice versa on all sides. But like, I don't have any confidence that any of those people, if they were to launch their own version of the Church Committee, would do what Frank Church did and spend, it took a long time, not only uncovering the problems, but instituting so many different reforms and things to do something about it. Unfortunately, I think it would take pop quiz. When's the last time that we actually reformed the US intelligence community from top to bottom?
Probably NSC, whatever in the
40s. It was earlier. It's later. 9/11. We destroyed the entire intelligence apparatus. Rewrote the laws. We had the Department of Homeland Security. We created the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Before, the CIA director actually used to be the head of all the different intelligence communities. Now we have the 17 different intel agencies that lead up to the ODNI, and the ODNI is like the overseer / manager of all of this. That was the last time that we had. We're living right now in the post 9/11 age. I think we all can acknowledge that there have been some real problems with the intel community since then, but we would need a similar catalyst in order to do something about it. And or at the very least, in order to get as serious as we were in those days after 9/11, to ask ourselves, okay, what went wrong? We haven't asked that question at a bureaucratic or at a congressional level to rewrite the law on how these things are going to work. It's been 20 years, 21 years since that happened. And in that time, institutional trust in those agencies has plummeted. Yes, much of it is the fact of the Biden administration, or the Bush administration, but it's time to do something more. I mean, look, if I was in politics, this is the type of stuff that the nitty gritty, not sexy part that takes a lot of work that I would try to focus on.
Man, I am so glad that we went here because once again, I didn't feel great about the debate because it didn't lead anywhere, but I think this is what the actual position is. And this kind of echoes. So we're going to keep talking about the Frank Church's committee. The reason why we know that the CIA was doing all these cockamamie schemes to kill Castro in the 60s is because of the Church Committee. Church. The reason why the CIA actually is not allowed to assassinate foreign leaders anymore is because of the Church Committee and the reforms that came out of this. So this
Title
is actually
50, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Very, very, very important stuff. And it actually speaks to, once again, we have hawkish listeners, we have dovish listeners. I said this on the episode of Dimitri, and Sagar, I really feel what you're saying around the need for accountability. The people who need to be, if I were, and once again, man, it's people write in whenever we say we don't want to be in politics. They get, once they realize this isn't just like once they realize we're not just saying it to say it, but we actually would
like,
not
no,
want
I
to
actually
do
don't
it.
Want
it's people feel really doomer when they hear that. And I think that's kind of a very doomer point. But the quick point here is, if I were in politics, so if you're doing the intelligence community thing, look, I'm a hawk, right? I'm a person who's like, send all the javelins to Ukraine, back Taiwan, renegotiate our relationship with Japan, stay in South Korea. It's on me then to recognize that my position in our generational cohort is not normal. It's not normal. It's not typical. And it's not typical or normal because, like you said, people don't trust the institutions. People don't trust the process that's gone on the last 20 years. And once again, if I am going to advance those positions, I need to be leading the committee on military graft. So once again, I'm talking about how, like, oh, the MIC isn't making all these decisions to make money, because I really think they're not. I genuinely believe it. But that being said, when I talked about last episode, the fact that I don't personally care that much that there's a contractor who's getting his third pool or his third vacation home because of those javelins to Ukraine, I am not saying that doesn't matter. I'm saying in the moment, that is an entirely fine thing to happen. And I always choose protecting people's lives over gotchas like that. But that being said, at a structural level, there really does need, I don't think anyone has any understanding of, but are we paying the right prices for those javelins? Is this actually the right structure? And one quick thing to add, Sarkis, because I know you'll get the historical reference. I talked about this with Dimitri. I don't think he knew what I was talking about. So we couldn't discuss it, but think of the Truman Committee during World War II. Why was Truman selected as the vice president? Why was he a prominent person? Because during World War II, aka the Great Good War, the war which literally no one was actually questioning for good reason, during that thing, he went around the country saying, hey, defense company, hey, contractor, hey, person. He would hold hearings, he would haul people before them. It'd be incredible. You want to talk about, like, people on YouTube will see this, like, moments and social media clips going wild. Imagine just being a young congressman or a young veteran. I mean, this is what Dan Crenshaw should be doing, honestly. Because once again, like, I agree with him more than you agree with him. But if he wanted people to take his position more seriously, he should be doing this. He should say, I so believe in America having an affirmative role in the world, but I'm going to make sure that there is no impropriety whatsoever. And the second I discover that third vacation house isn't just because you've really built the greatest weapons technology ever, but it's because you're corrupt or it's because you've manipulated the process, I will destroy you in the front of the cameras. Like, I think that's why I'm really frustrated.
But yeah, and that's what Truman did. That's what people need to understand. Truman was one of the most popular heroes in the United States at the time. The Truman Committee was on the front page of the New York Times because of a lot of the influence of Smedley Butler. Look him up. We did a whole episode on it, which is that people did not trust war profiteering. And so you needed this haberdasher, bean counter senator who was willing to get into his car. And yes, he literally did this and drive across the entire country in his car by himself and show up sight unseen at these factories, and he would caught and prosecute fraud to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars at the time, gave American confidence that the war machine was working on their behalf. This again is where you have to look at the Bush administration and KBR, Kermit Brown and Root and Halliburton. I mean, some of this is just downtrodden conspiracy stuff, but some of this shit is true. I mean, KBR made a shitload of money off the war in Iraq by serving like Taco Bell in cafeterias in Afghanistan. Did they really need to charge us, you know, $25 or whatever, a plate?
Maybe. Let's find out.
Maybe. Yeah. But like, okay, it'd be really great if we had a real committee in order to figure out where that was. I mean, one something point I try to make on the show, just because the military industrial complex can seem very amorphous, it's like, look, we obviously have to build weapons. The biggest problem right now is the people who build our weapons are doing a shit job. The F-35 is a world historic boondoggle of a program. In the way that we purchase weapons, it's terrible. There is the new, I forget what it's called. It's not a battleship because it's not the right terminology. Naval geeks are going to get pissed at me, but whatever. There's like three different types of new U.S. warships. We were originally going to build 26. So the guns that were on these ships.
This is the Zumwalt class.
It's very cool. It's got a stealthy triangle type shape. Yeah, it's radar defeat, all this cool stuff. Anyway. They're 26. They were supposed to build 26. We're only up building three. So there's a gun on board, which is very high tech and it's very useful, all of this. But because the economy and scale for 26 never materialized, it costs $1 million a round to fire the fucking gun. Which, so now the Navy is now not buying. So now we have these guns, which cost untold billions to create, sitting there. You can't even fire the goddamn gun. And if we ever went to war, it would cost $1 million a round in order to do so. I mean, I have countless numbers of these stories where we end up justifying all sorts of bullshit technology that we have for the most useless things. Oh, this is one of my favorite ones. When I was covering ISIS, we did this bombing campaign in Libya, okay, against ISIS. ISIS ain't got no fucking anti-aircraft. So what do we do? Here's what we do. We sent a bomber from somewhere like Mississippi, a B-2, to fly a 32-hour mission from the United States to Libya and back. Do you know what the operating cost of a B-2 soccer. Bomber is?
Because everyone's a tech military. Yeah. That's the stealth. People, that's the stealth.
Yeah,
that's
stealth
the significance. This is a stealth bomber designed to drop nukes on the Soviet Union.
Exactly. We sent a B-2 bomber. I might be getting this wrong. It could be a B-1, one of these, which costs like $30,000 a minute to fly to drop a bomb on a ragtag group pulling AK-47s. And it's stuff like that that drives me crazy, where it's inefficient, it's legitimately stupid, and it shows you that the boondoggle is not just like fighting the wars for money. I think the wars are going to happen anyway. It's the insane level of inefficiency that ends up happening. I mean, I heard a story once, one of my favorite stories, in Afghanistan. This is another perfect example about what happened, which is that we provided the Afghan, you know, the great Afghan forces with some Humvees. And we're like, hey guys, you guys should use these Humvees to go kill the Taliban. And they kept requisitioning all this gas in order to run these Humvees. And the military, General Dunford at the time, who was later the chairman, he was a commander of US forces, was trying to figure, he's like, how are the Afghans using all this gas? They're not killing that much Taliban, but they're asking us for all this gas. Yeah, well, the most cynical people, and that's what you should assume in Afghanistan, have already figured out what's happening. The Afghans were taking the gas from us and then they're selling it on the side. And also the guys who were transporting this gas, yeah, they're making a shitload of money in order to do so. So it's stuff like this where these ridiculous boondoggles and things happen. It's not that we don't need to have people who build weapons. It's that the people who do are terrible at their jobs, spend an outrageous amount of money, and also make the troops a lot less safe. A lot of the guys who went to war in Iraq, you know, in 2003, there's a great HBO series, Generation Kill. Everybody should go watch it. I think it was in 2008, based on the forwardmost column in Iraq. He had sold the U.S. Marines having to order their own turrets and replace these shitty 1980s Humvees while rolling into a U.S. invasion because we did not requisition the right technology. I mean, this goes all the way, you know, up to the top. And the average grunt is the person who pays the price.
And we've got to move on to Q&A's to finish up and everything. But no, I just want to say, like, I think the audience is going to be pumped with this, because the point was, we left it at a point where people were just saying, I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I think Marshall's right that we're not going to be the only country on earth without an intelligence community, but Sagar's right that there's this real lack of trust that prevents people from operating in good faith. So we just left this in a place where, once again, someone should basically pick this up. Okay, so we're going to do Q&A. Literally so many coming in, so we'll try to get as many as possible. But I want to read a quick comment, because it's such a good comment and it's very smart. We didn't get this. So this comment is from, sorry, let me just scroll up. This comment, of course, I always screw this up. Okay, from Teresa H. Just a comment after listening to your last podcast on Ukraine. I think it's not easy to know where the populist right lines would be drawn on this issue after a few months. Early on in COVID, a lot of people on the right were more worried than the left. Such a good point. There's this Vanity Fair article that, Sagar, you remember, where it was, wait, why is Cernovich, Steve Bannon, all these right wingers who we think are bad in the Trump context, really worried about COVID. They also threw in Matt Stoller, which is a funny thing. There's obviously something going on there too. Not in terms of them being bad faith, but Stoller was also an early COVID hawk. But as we saw, that entirely changed. So I think you and I were probably a little too cavalier on talking about how the populist fight would respond, because the honest thing is that, you know, who knows where this is at in 6 months. So to a question specifically then, let's go with this. So Dan D, this is actually a very important one. My question is, can you articulate the theory behind why direct military conflict with Russia automatically brings the threat of nuclear war, other than both sides having nuclear weapons? Quick thing editorially, I think it's important to capture. Sagar and pretty much everyone else has been saying, but one of the main reasons we should not get involved in the conflict with our troops is that there's a threat of nuclear war. I understand the pretense here, but it's just not quite clear to me why killing a Spetsnaz officer could lead to nuclear war. So Sagar, IR hat, go back to Georgetown, put the hat on, other hat, I guess, in this case. What's your response?
It requires actually reading U.S. military war plans in the Cold War and most currently. And Marshall, you have that book, The Bomb. I've been reading the hell out of it. It is core to understand that in any confrontation between these two nations, it was understood at the highest level that an incursion in West Berlin is not an incursion in West Berlin. It is a full-blown nuclear exchange. That generally remains the case. And killing a Spetsnaz officer, that's a little bit more low level. Take it to what it really means, Marshall, which is shooting planes out of the sky. And actually, I encourage people to go read what General Breedlove, Mr. No-Fly Zone, actually advocated for. Here is General Breedlove's declaration for what a no-fly zone means. It's not just shooting Russian planes out of the sky. U.S. Air Force doctrine says that enforcement of a no-fly zone is not only actively shooting planes that are above Ukrainian military airspace, it is also required that we defend U.S. aircraft. And the only way to defend U.S. aircraft in the event that they are engaged requires the United States to actively bomb and take out anti-air systems that are stationed within the nation of Russia. So now we are not just talking about a no-fly zone. We are talking not even just talking about shooting Russian planes that are attacking Ukraine out of the sky. If a single missile attacks the United States aircraft, we are then required, as per doctrine, not required, but the default thing that will kick into place is then the United States Air Force bombing anti-aircraft systems stationed in Russia. And now, whenever Russia's going to respond, Russia's military doctrine, most military doctrines are not that different, will require them to take out forward deployed U.S. Air Force facilities, which are being used for this campaign, which are stationed in NATO. And now what do we have here? We have a total clusterfuck. This is why I think it's important for people not to be cavalier about these things and understand what the military doctrine of all of these things actually mean. The scenario I just outlined, that actually would lead, I think would lead to a nuclear exchange.
And a quick thing, I get where the audience member is coming from, because the flaw in his understanding of what people are saying is the word automatically.
Yeah.
No one is claiming that the second a U.S. plane gets shot out of the sky, Biden pushes the button and a nuke goes. The better way to think of nuclear war, and we're going to do an episode on nuclear war because everyone is obviously incredibly interested for very morbid reasons, it's risk. Risk is the word that matters here. The point isn't that a plane gets shot out of the sky and we push the button. The point is, plane gets shot out of the sky, that means escalation. If there's escalation, the risk goes up. So it goes from there's a 0.01% chance of a nuclear war that destroys the US and Russia. Some would argue even 0.01 is even too high, but then that goes from 0.01 to 1%. Okay, now there's a A-10 Warthog that shoots down that knocks out a bunch of Russian tanks, but they happen to knock out a Russian general who is leading that column. Okay, that guy, and that's the way to think about it. So once again, you are right I'm talking to the questioner here, and that no one is claiming automatically, and we shouldn't conceive of this stuff as automatic. The point is risk. And under Sagar's framework, a no-fly zone increases the risk of nuclear conflagration. And really think about this. I know people, I'm personally terrible at statistics, talking about a C minus in AP stats back in senior year. Maybe that's a senior writer speaking, but even a 1% chance, that's too high. If you really think of what nuclear war means. So really great question. Thanks for the thing there. Okay. So second, I'll answer this one first. Hello from California. I love the podcast. Was wondering what your opinion on the UN is. I've heard a lot of people criticize it. I'm also confused why some countries have super vetoes. Russia just vetoed resolution against them. So what's the point? Great question, because it speaks to these post-World War II international institutions just breaking down. Quick history lesson. We're doing a lot of those on these episodes, but I think they're useful. The UN was formed. You know, this is what FDR wanted. FDR is a person who was in Woodrow Wilson's administration. He saw the League of Nations collapse. When he actually ran for vice president in 1920, he affirmatively was making the case that Democrats should run under the banner of the League of Nations, which, once again, as we know, the US never ratified, but was basically made superfluous by Italy and Germany's aggression and Japan's in the 1930s. All those countries ended up withdrawing. So the United Nations was supposed to be the successor, where you could have peaceful resolution of issues. And the reason why certain countries have vetoes is, once again, this is an artifact of what happened during World War II. The UN actually starts before World War II ends. This is a situation where you had the five powers, these are the allied powers who've come together, who are seeking to build a post-war order. And, you know, at the time, we were obviously tenuous frenemies with Russia. So there wasn't a Cold War at that moment. There were hints of it, but it wasn't there yet. But also, do not forget, China was technically, it was the Republic of China. So this was Chiang Kai-shek, the Chinese nationalists who would lose the Civil War and go to where they are now in Taiwan. So it was not communist China that was that member. So these were the five allies. They were going to set the rules and build this world. Obviously, that's not quite fair from a pure, like, why can't countries have vetoes? But from a pure, like, moral perspective, it wasn't fair. Yeah, sure. But what was important there is that idea of vetoes better reflected the nature of great power politics than the League of Nations. So the League of Nations is, all the countries are going to get together and Abyssinia and Italy are going to meet and talk and it's chill. No, the point of the UN was, there are five powers. One of them has nukes. Another one, Britain, is going to get nukes eventually. The Soviets get nukes. They are going to set the rules and promote peace. Unfortunately, that structure is one that just basically doesn't work. And just a quick side answer too here. I want to say, you know, there are some people who, in a separate cohort of the, like, why did we expand NATO versus group of people who say, like, hey, like, Vladimir Putin wanted to be in NATO, we should have let him in, that was unfair. Whether or not we should have expanded, we never should have let Putin into NATO itself. Because I think the lesson of the UN is, you actually need institutions where you just do not have unaligned actors. And Russia in NATO, for good or for ill, would have been an unaligned actor. Putin would not have lined up with Poland, would not have lined up with Hungary. And then the whole institution means nothing, like the UN today. But Sagar, what's your take? We've got time.
That's a pretty good summary. My take is, they have vetoes because they're the most important countries on earth. And it was a recognition that great power politics requires their ability, where even if it may not be fair, that they have more of a veto because they have the greatest and largest militaries on earth. It's a simple, hard power acknowledgement. But yeah, I mean, I think the UN is mostly useless anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
And look, let's also not forget, the only reason why the Korean War was a UN intervention that the US led, technically a police action, was Russia was vetoing. Russia was boycotting. Yeah, so they boycotting. Couldn't use their veto. So once again, the only time the UN truly, beyond just like meeting with people, and look, there's food programs, I'm not going to attack like the more like domestic side, but in terms of issues of war and peace, which I think is what we're all most interested in here, the last time it truly mattered was that time when one of the vetoers wasn't there. Okay, so next and last question. I know, I'm sorry, we can't hit everything, but we will do as many as possible. Let's get a good one here for Sagar. You know, you write these down and then you write down too many. Oh, let's just do a quick comment on the Here's what Brooks writes. What are your thoughts on the mass private sector canceling of Russia? For example, Pixar canceling movie releases in Russia, Adidas canceling the partnership with the Russian national soccer team, Netflix leaving the market. I could go on forever. Is this a bad approach? Is this a set of precedent down the road for future geopolitical events? What's the root of this? Is this a weird version of virtue signaling? I just feel like the government should be the ones controlling foreign policy. Maybe I'm wrong to feel weird about it. We'd just love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, it's funny. We've been talking about this with a lot of our friends. I share your discontent and your discomfort with it. It's not, and I'm not going to do one of those things where it should be banned. What I would more say is we have to be careful with these things. One of the important things about government action is that they can be reversed, whereas, and it's centrally directed and has some sort of democratic input. So sanctions against Russian oil imports or Russian airspace, well, it's very clear. And I think we should make it clear to Putin. They're like, hey man, Aeroflot, it can start coming back to New York tomorrow. Just stop what's happening in Ukraine. It gets more complicated with some of these like Pixar movies, or I just saw FIFA is going to be taking Russia off of its gaming system. More of the geopolitical kind of canceling, quote unquote, to what you're using. I think what it gets to is the feeling, and I think correct feeling, that there is a slow roll, seeming one-upsmanship that's happening in popular culture without a consideration of what the ramifications of those decisions are, and if and when what off ramps exist within your company. So a company like Apple has to, like Apple Pay, for example, has to be abide by SWIFT regulations with credit card processing. That's up to the government. That's not up to Apple. But Pixar or something, or actually EA Sports taking Russia off of FIFA is the perfect example, where it's like, okay, well, when do they get to be put back on? Or are you saying that that's forever? It's still, like, whatever. I don't give a shit about FIFA. I never played. But it's just one of those things where we should have more of a consideration. And this is always the aspect too with canceling too. And all of my concern is that in these private sector places, that there's not a lot of that consideration happening. And it's just a lot of groupthink.
And what I would just add to finish this one up, because Sagar needs to run, is look, I get the discomfort, but Sagar, like you said last week with me saying, why can't we live in a world where everyone trusts everything? There are certain realities of the 21st century. I did an episode with Alec on this. Corporations, private groups, organizations, there are non-state-based actors that are just huge deals now. And that is something that Putin should have considered. There is no law that forces Disney. There's no word where Disney has to be. And you're not claiming that. But my point is, like, this is now a thing. Like, the reality here is, like, we can feel uncomfortable about this, but this is just not going away. And this is, like, once again, like, not, like, it's kind of funny. This is obvious existing in the opposite thing. You know how we usually say, like, look, like, we did our Eric Schwartzel episode, like, Hollywood is not American anymore. These are global multinational corporations. In the same way, if that means that they're not going to do things we like when it comes to creating good, like, pro-American movies, it also means that during an invasion, if their workforce and their people are like, look, this is bad, they're going to do that. So this is a weird example of how in the 21st century, it's not just countries, but there are states that in some ways can do things that feel like they're what states do. And that's why you feel uncomfortable, but that's how it works. And in cases which are especially, like, so if I was using this argument to say, like, that's why they can't pay taxes, that's bad. But in these other areas, this is the weird gray zone. I suggest you go back and listen to the Alec Ross episode. Guys, this has been really, really, really great. Keep the questions coming. Like I said, I'm posting these every single day for the next few weeks, because we could take this through so many different angles. This is really great. So hope you enjoyed the show. And once again, send a tip if you enjoyed as well. Substack's coming out today as well too. Sagar, any closing words?
No, that's it. Make sure you guys sub to that Substack. Sending the tips is really appreciated. We'll see you guys later.